Welcome to our special live remote broadcast from the 2014 Chadwick Arboretum and Learning Gardens plant sale on the Ohio State University campus. Check out the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides for details about the event, which goes on through tomorrow. Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In Ohio, the combination of farming and development has spawned toxic runoffs of fertilizers. Last year, beaches along Buckeye Lake and Lake Erie were closed due to the dangerously high algae levels. And at the shallow 13,000-acre Grand Lake St. Mary in western Ohio, decomposing algae robbed the water of oxygen needed to support fish and other aquatic creatures. Coming up, we'll hear from the Ohio Farm Bureau about pending legislation aimed at the farming community. We'll also get some organic home gardening advice from an Oakland nursery expert. Joining us now is OSU Food, Agriculture, and Biological Engineering Professor Andy Ward. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
So what are the actual dangers from algae? Why is it dangerous?
The main dangers are They can affect the liver, they can affect the brain, so you have neurotoxins, you have liver toxins, you have skin toxins. The dangers so far have been fairly minimal to humans in Ohio, but people who are unaware are certainly going to get rashes, they're going to get upset stomachs. There have been a number of pets that have died due to the situation. It's a very visible problem, so as long as people are aware that it's a visible problem and they come across something that looks like a witch's brew of green pea soup, you can walk away from it. So it's not invisible. The bigger problem that we've seen is actually the effect it has on the environment. So I think right now that the health problems have caused economic hardship for people, particularly in areas where there's tourism, recreation, sport fishing, places like that. But the actual health dangers have mainly been what I would call a nuisance kind of problem so far. But I think that's because there's been good action by officials in those areas to make sure things were shut down in a timely fashion.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are broadcasting live from the Chadwick Arboretum and Learning Gardens annual plant sale. For more information, go to our website at wosu.org/allsides. We're talking about agricultural runoff this hour, the dangers, what's being done about it at the state and local level. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. What is the danger to the environment? Can you describe the sorts of impact it's having on the environment?
Yeah, let me just start off with something that I think the listeners will find interesting is the harmful algae blooms are actually not an algae. They're a cyanobacteria. So, but they're a bacteria that acts like an algae. And I think for most people, calling them a blue-green algae because that's what they look like is a good way of thinking of it. But basically, what's happening is nutrient discharges, in particular phosphorus and now dissolved reactive phosphorus, sometimes called soluble reactive phosphorus, triggers these blooms. And it's not a new problem. 1972, there was actually a joint agreement for the Great Lakes and Lake Erie to prevent this problem, and that was a very successful joint agreement with Canada, where we actually reduced the size of the blooms enormously until about the mid-1990s, and then suddenly they started reappearing again, and what was discovered was that actually this dissolved reactive phosphorus, which is just a small part of the phosphorus, was actually increasing. So a combination of things. Changes in the environment, larger storm events, the way we do our farming, maybe putting fall applications of fertilizers, perhaps the no-till is a very good practice, and maybe we'll talk about that later, but some of the practices we were broadcasting, just placing the fertilizer on the surface of the land, so there was more opportunity for that fertilizer to run off. So it gets into the environment. These blooms occur, and then the algae or the bacteria starts dying. And when it starts dying, it starts, an easy way of thinking of it, it starts sucking oxygen out of the water. And then the aquatic life have got less light because of the algae, they've got less oxygen, and you get a decline in the quality of the aquatic life. And the aquatic life in those systems are actually very important in keeping them clean.
Grand Lake St. Mary's didn't always have this problem, though. You'd mentioned the 1972 joint agreement between the Great Lakes states and Canada. But the inland lakes, were they as much of a problem back in the 70s as they are now?
No, I don't think so. And I think Grand Lake St. Mary is perhaps a little bit different than some of the other lakes. The drainage area to that lake has very intensive livestock agriculture, and the problem with that is it creates a need to dispose of manure, and we dispose of the manure on the land, and gradually you get buildups. So over time you get buildups of nutrients in the soil profile, and then that gets released, and that's an artificial lake that's very shallow, as is Lake Erie. So most of the other Great Lakes actually don't have the same harmful algae bloom problem we do. They might have hypoxia problems, which are just this reduction in oxygen, which are still big problems that we see all the way from the Great Lakes down to the Gulf of Mexico.
Right. This isn't just a local problem. It reaches all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. How does that happen?
Well, a large part of Ohio, in fact, the majority of it actually drains down towards the Ohio River, and then that's a tributary of the Mississippi River. And you know, we're part of one of the most important and most intensive corn and soybean production system areas in the world. So a very high percentage of those crops are from this area, and your Farm Bureau guest, I'm sure, will talk about that. So, you know, although it seems like it's a long way away, the reality is that the North Central region, and we're part of that, or the Midwest is what people often think of it as, actually contributes to problems both to the north and to the south. But I think one thing, a point I'd like to make is that we should be careful about saying that farming is a problem, because the efficiency of farmers in terms of using phosphorus is probably more than 97%. And if you think of what we do in the household in terms of using water and letting the tap run and using electricity and driving to work without anyone else in the car and throwing food away, our efficiency in terms of things that all relate to water is extremely low. So we're looking at very, very efficient systems, and we're talking about 1 or 2 ounces, maybe as much as a pound of phosphorus per acre coming off in a whole year is actually causing the problem. So it's a very tiny fraction of what's being applied. So it's a real challenge to agriculture, particularly as any solution is probably going to cost some money, is going to impact on the viability of farming, which is an extremely important part of the state of Ohio and our economy and the world as well. We're basically one of the biggest food production areas in the world, and every American farmer feeds 2 Americans and feeds 1 person overseas.
The methods that farmers use to that you mentioned, no-till. Can you explain what you mean by no-till and talk about other things that have affected it in terms of the methods of farming?
Yes. If we go back to when European settlement first came to the U.S., we would have a very diverse farming system, and it was basically subsistence farming. And then gradually we would become more specialized, and people would barter, and someone would produce one crop and someone else would produce another one. But then gradually over time we got to where it made more sense to have a small range of crops in a particular area and then a different range of crops in another geographic area of the nation. So we're in an area, particularly in the northern part of the state, where corn, soybeans, and wheat are the dominant crops. Well, when you've got a system like that, one of the challenges is sustaining the health of the soil. So a no-till system is really, it's more of a reduced tillage system, mm-hmm. where we leave some of the residue from one crop in that system, and then that helps to improve soil organic matter. It helps to reduce erosion. it also disturbs the soil less, so the potential for soil erosion is reduced. So we've gone to systems which are not as intensively tilled as we used to, and they all have positive benefits, but in some cases they might affect how water moves through the system or how runoff occurs. So it's not always that every part of the system is going to be 100% perfect and in terms of all the issues that we're trying to address.
What about how close farming operations occur to water, bodies of water, moving water, that kind of thing?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Pre-European settlement, northern Ohio was primarily marshlands and wetlands. And when there was a large rainfall event, the water would spread across the landscape, and the landscape was a natural biological treatment system and a sponge. For a variety of reasons, the Great Black Swamp in northwest Ohio was drained, partly because of diseases and to make the land livable. It then became one of our best agricultural areas. But in order to do that, we had to install subsurface drainage to remove that water. So that created a new kind of system, and that water had to go somewhere, so we built ditches. So a lot of our headwater systems, particularly in northwest Ohio, are actually agricultural ditches where there used not to be any kind of surface system at all. So those ditches then discharge into our streams. So it's important that we recognize that the ditches serve two functions now. One is they were put there to help drain land. But the other one is they discharge into our stream system, so they need to also do that at minimal adverse impact. So what one of the problems is that the more land we can farm, the greater the income is going to be for the farmer. And if we farm right up next to the stream, then we're going to get ag chemicals getting into the stream quicker. So we've had practices for many, many years now where farmers put buffers in, and a very large percentage of farmers do that. But we still have coming into those ditches flows from subsurface drains. And they're a very important part of agriculture, not just in Ohio, but in the Midwest. So we have water going down through the soil, getting into a buried plastic pipe in the ground, and then that discharges into a ditch. So it'll bypass some of the buffers. So what we need to do is look at a practice that will reduce the impact of the ditches. So I think, you know, I made a couple of notes here, and I think the readers might be, your listeners might be interested. There are really just a few ways to solve the problem. You know, one is to put less chemicals out there. And the phosphorus use has declined by about halved in the last 50 years. So the farmer's already doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, perhaps we can put even less on there, become even more efficient. If we can make the soils more self-sustaining, we're going to have a better system. So there's a number of practices, cover crops, crops in rotations, the reduced tillage, all of those, maybe using soil amendments such as gypsum. All of those practices are going to improve the soil health. But one of the things that we've got to recognize, particularly in Ohio, is that if we have less water coming off the field, then we're going to have less of a problem. So there's a new practice now which is called controlled drainage, where we actually only drain the field for the part of the year that we need to do that. And for the rest of the year, we keep the water back up in the field, and it'll evaporate, and sometimes it'll actually provide a little bit of a benefit.
So you shut off the sub-drainage?
Shut off the drainage.
Okay.
You know, if we can reduce the amount of water, if we can increase the plant available water in the soil profile, so there's more for the plant and less going into the environment, that's going to be a good strategy. So, you know, there's a lot of strategies. Precision farming, that helps us put the chemicals where we want. So industry has a strategy that they develop, which I think is an appropriate one, which really addresses the efficiency, which is called the 4 R's, which is putting the fertilizers at the right place at the right time, the right source. So, you go in and the trouble with this practice like that is we don't know yet how to quantify the benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes you have years like this year where we're way behind on getting the crop in. So you're squeezed with time to get the crop in. So you can't always do it at the right time, you know, because weather gets in the way.
That darn weather.
That darn weather, yeah.
I'm talking with Andy Ward. He's a professor of food, agriculture, and biological engineering at Ohio State University. We are on the campus of Ohio State University this morning, broadcasting live from the Chadwick Arboretum and Learning Gardens annual plant sale. If you want to learn more about that, drop on by. Check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We're talking about agricultural runoff. We're talking about runoff into our water systems that are creating harmful algae growths, as Andy said earlier, the cyanobacteria, actually, that's a product of that. It's causing a lot of problems for wildlife, the environment. Of course, it's a danger to humans and pets and so forth. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Welcome to our special live remote broadcast from the 2014 Chadwick Arboretum and Learning Gardens plant sale on the OSU campus. For more information about the location and times, check out the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Last year, beaches along Buckeye Lake and Lake Erie were closed due to the dangerously high algae levels. And at the 13,000-acre Grand Lake St. Mary in western Ohio, decomposing algae robbed the water of oxygen, suffocating many fish every summer now. Because farmland runoff is the cause of the high algae levels, state lawmakers are at work on legislation that would govern how commercial fertilizers are used. Coming up, we'll get some advice on organic gardening for the home from an Oakland nursery expert. Still with us is OSU Food, Agriculture and Biological Engineering Professor Andy Ward. And joining us now is the Vice President of Public Policy for the Ohio Farm Bureau, Adam Sharp. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So Ohio lawmakers are working on legislation to control runoff from farms, among other things. It would give the state authority to cite farmers for pollution violations. There's a distinction in Ohio between large farms that already need permits and to operate in smaller farms. What's the difference? What kind of change are we talking about?
Yeah, I think first thing to mention is that this is it's a big deal. You know, this is a very big deal for the state of Ohio water quality, and farmers and the agriculture community have really recognized that. And this is one of those issues where you can either kind of bury your head in the sand, or you can say, no, we are part of this issue and we're going to resolve our part of this problem. We know there are other sources of nutrients that come into the lakes. We know that. But we also know that depending on the watershed, agriculture can either be a small part of the issue or a very large part of the issue in some watersheds. So farmers stepping up to the plate here and recognizing this as an issue is a big deal. And that's the first thing I'd like to make and point I'd like to put out there. But the interesting part is your question is kind of the small farm, large farm. The issue doesn't really go to that. It actually goes to the types of nutrient that's being applied to the land.
So it's the type of farm?
It's the type of farm,
okay.
And it's the type of nutrient. And really, it's just two areas, so it's pretty simple. It's either commercial fertilizer or it's manure. Those are the two areas of distinction under law in Ohio of how you regulate, and in most states, how you regulate nutrients. So here in Ohio, the legislation that's now pending, and actually should be passed this week, so good timing here on your show, this legislation would deal with commercial fertilizer. You're correct on your initial statement of, is there different types of regulation on different types of farms? And yes, larger livestock farms right now have to be permitted for their nutrient, how they handle their nutrients, how they manage their nutrients, manure, how they apply it to fields, and how they store it. And they have to be zero discharge. So on those operations, on those larger livestock farms in Ohio, you have to gain a permit through the Ohio Department of Agriculture and also through the US EPA typically to be able to operate. And to do that, you have to prove that you're not having any discharge of that manure from that farm into the waters of the state. Now, also then when you move that manure from the farm out to the field, you have to also then have a plan in place that shows how you're going to apply that manure on those fields to make sure that you're not getting runoff. So that's one part of the regulation. Now, every other farm of any other size, so if you're not the largest farm, anybody else from, you know, several cows on up to those several thousand animal farms, they also come underneath Ohio law. They're regulated by the Ohio Department of Natural Resources. So that manure is also regulated. If you have a problem, if you're applying manure in a way that it ends up in the creek or ends up someplace where it shouldn't be, then the state of Ohio has a right to ask you then, in fact, tell you, you have to be permitted. And you have to then go through the same process that a larger farm would have to go through to make sure you're also doing the right things with that manure. So manure has been regulated in the state for a long time. So we have existing manure regulation. This new issue involves commercial fertilizer. And the new effort here with the Ohio legislature is to pass legislation that now regulates, if you will, and certifies farmers for applying fertilizer on anything more than 50 acres. So this is the new direction with the legislation that's pending and will be passed. We're expecting this week.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guests, Adam Sharp, I'm talking with him now from the Ohio Farm Bureau, and also with us, Andy Ward. He's a food agriculture and biological engineering professor at OSU. If you have a question about agricultural runoff, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Farmers would also have to undergo training and get, and as you said, get certification before they could spread commercial fertilizer. According to one version of the bill, and apparently the one that's going to pass now, the training part, is that still part of the conversation? Why is it necessary?
Yeah, it absolutely is. The bill has three major components to it. The bill was written by Senators Bob Peterson and Senators Cliff Height, also the Ohio Department of Agriculture, Ohio Department of Natural Resources, and Ohio EPA all had a part to do with writing this bill. And yes, it has three main components. Probably the largest component of it, and really the first time in the country, any state requiring all farmers who are applying fertilizer on more than 50 acres have to be certified. So you'll have to have a license. If you think about it in the term of like a driver's license, you'll have to go once every 3 years, you'll have to go through an education course that will teach what Andy referred to earlier as the four R's. So applying fertilizer at the right time, at the right place, in the right form, and the right amount. So making sure that you're applying fertilizer in the right ways and using the latest data, the latest science, the latest techniques. Farmers are very good about learning to be more efficient, about learning new techniques for agricultural practices. But there's always more to be learned. And OSU will likely be involved in this education course and walking farmers through the latest and greatest, if you will, of how do you become more efficient with your fertilizer application. So this is a big deal. First state in the country that requires, we figure, tens of thousands of farmers in the state will have to go through this course. It could be at least 10, probably 20,000 farmers, maybe more, who have to take this course and be certified. That is a requirement that's a mandatory requirement of this bill. We think that's a big deal. And frankly, we hope it's going to really help. We think it's meaningful. Farmers, as you can imagine, were a little hesitant when you first started to hear about this legislation, this approach. Very hesitant. But at the same time, recognizing that there is an issue and this is something they absolutely can do to help this issue is important. There are two other parts to this bill. There's a revocation authority. If you're a bad actor, so if you kind of ignore, if you will, good practices and you end up applying fertilizer that ends up someplace where it shouldn't, you can have that license in revoked. So there's teeth to the certification. You don't just go get trained. You can actually lose that certification.
But are there
going
to be enough people out inspecting?
Yeah, so
that's
resources,
always a problem when
absolutely.
It comes to the environment.
This is something that that the agriculture community, and certainly we know the state certainly holds this up as a big deal, is making sure that you have enough resources in this bill to make sure you can actually implement what you're putting forth here. So the training, and I know that the Department of Agriculture is working with Ohio State University right now on the training side of this issue. But then also when you look at what's the system out there that we have in place, and yes, we do have a terrific network across the state of Ohio with our local soil and water conservation districts. So these are folks in every single county across the state who will be involved in this issue. They'll be involved in working with farmers. They'll be involved in the educational side of this. And as many programs are in the state of Ohio, they are They are complaint driven, but there's also there also is the ability of the state to be out there checking and talking to farmers. The third part of the bill is record retention. So this gives the right of the state to come and ask a farmer, can I see your records? You have to retain records.
Okay.
And you have to then show those records of what you've done on that land. So there is that third component, too, that makes that enforcement part, if you will, work. It gives a backstop to just the visual. There also is the records check.
The state had proposed moving oversight of farmland, manure, runoff, that stuff, from the Department of Natural Resources to the Department of Agriculture. Yeah. Is that going to be in the final version of the bill, or is that other legislation?
That is a separate piece of legislation. Yeah, very separate.
What about
piece.
That?
Yeah, so the idea there that the government has put forward is efficiency. So right now, as I kind of outlined to you here in the beginning, mm-hmm. is you have nutrients being regulated by two different state agencies,
right.
which isn't
one
necessarily...
One for small farms, one for larger...
Well, yeah, for livestock right now, for manure,
yeah.
right? So you have Department of Agriculture who's regulating manure for larger farms, and then Department of Natural Resources for all other size farms.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is to consolidate that. So move from the Department of Natural Resources, that manure regulatory component, over to ODA. And then also, of course, this commercial fertilizer piece will be at ODA as well. So what the government has talked about, and I can't pretend to speak for them, but of course they're looking for efficiency. They're making sure that they have a good program that's looking at all nutrients and that all regulation of nutrients are under one authority and one department. And that's probably a good thing for efficiency, for cost, and hopefully as well, I think it will very much show for benefit.
The advocacy group Lake Erie Waterkeeper has said that in other states, enforcement responsibilities are separated between agencies and that they would prefer that oversight occur at the state EPA or at the Ohio Department of Natural Resources. In other words, the Ohio Department of Agriculture might just be too close with farmers, might not have the same
right.
sort of attention to detail,
right.
That sort of thing. It's too cozy.
Yeah, and of course we hear this a lot, and you know, this is not an agriculture proposal, to be clear. We actually mm-hmm. don't have an opinion yet about this transfer of authority. What I will say, and you know, and I used to work for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and was the deputy director of our U.S. pesticides program for the United States. Something that we often forget is that the delegation of the authority for regulation of pesticides, while it's held at US EPA at the federal level, is delegated to the departments of agriculture in every state, including Ohio. So for over 40 years, pesticide regulation, which is a critical program in our environmental laws, has been run by our Department of Agriculture here in Ohio for that entire length of time, and they do a terrific job at it. One is they have the experts. When these guys go out to work with a farmer and look at a farm, they actually know what they're looking at. They know who they're looking at. They know what they're doing. They know what the practices are. And therefore, frankly, they can probably regulate better because they know how to deal with the farmer and they know what practices are going to work and not work. I hear the argument. We've heard the argument many times, of course, on this. But kind of the history shows, if you will, in the implementation of other programs, the Department of Agriculture does a terrific job. Livestock regulation in the state of Ohio for manure has been under the Ohio Department of Agriculture now for more than a decade.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it was moved to the Department of Agriculture after we did have some manure issues here in the state mm-hmm. back around 2000 in the late 90s. And since then, they've done a terrific job, and you just haven't heard about these issues anymore because they've dealt with it. So I think there's actually a very good record there.
Now,
could I just
ahead,
jump
Andy.
In? I think also one of the things that we need to recognize is Ohio EPA actually has a lot of oversight in terms of our waterways. And in fact, there's new legislation coming out of Washington related to waters of the nation. So I think some of our systems now, which maybe aren't covered, are going to be covered by that legislation. So, you know, the downstream place where all the problem is that we're worried about is to a very large extent regulated through Ohio EPA. So, you know, I'm not sure that they should be in the business of trying to decide whether a farmer's putting the right fertilizers on or not. That's really a farming activity. But when we take a sample from a water in a ditch or out of a tile or in a lake and it doesn't meet the water quality standards of the state, that's where Ohio EPA is going to jump in. So I think there is more than one player looking at this issue, and Ohio EPA does play a very important role. And they're probably the biggest agency looking at the Gulf of Mexico hypoxia problem. And they've been doing that for a couple of decades now.
We're going to hear from Kay now in Westerville. She wants to talk about those tiles that you talked about, the drainage tiles that have been installed, primarily in the northern part where this big swamp used to be,
yep.
And what happened to them. Hi, Kay in Westerville. You're on the air.
Hello. I wonder, my grandfather's farm was in northwestern Ohio, and I remember hearing that it was all tiled before there was such a thing as plastic. And I just wonder, now that some of those farms are going to residential areas, what happens to the tile? Do they forget about it? Do they dig it up? Do they replace
That's a good
it?
Question. It's still down there, maybe?
Yeah, it's a great question. Typically, the clay tiles were a little bit shallower than the plastic pipes are put in today. We still have many farms that are still using the old clay tiles. So often we have fields that have both plastic pipes in them and clay tiles, and they certainly cause a problem with development. I think the listeners touched on a problem that we actually have, and that is we're also losing land to development.
Right.
So, you know, we're caught between a rock and a hard place in terms of producing enough food and providing the living environment that people want.
But there's no regulation that requires the tiles be removed?
No.
At this point?
No.
No, not directly.
No.
And,
so there's still
Andy,
down there draining stuff Andy, that doesn't need to be drained.
Well, you know, a lot of times farmers on the farm fields will replace the clay tiles with a newer plastic tile because they do blow out. They do get old, and you do end up with holes in those tile, and it just doesn't work. So you remove them. We've been removing a lot of them on our farm over the last couple of years and replacing them with plastic. But in development, it's a great question. It hits close to home for me. My mother was building a new house just southeast of Columbus here a couple years ago. It was in a development that used to be a farm field. And right through the middle of that development was an old clay tile line that the developer forgot and didn't realize was there and didn't remove. And they built the house, and oh my gosh, it flooded the basements of about three different houses because the developer just didn't realize the tile was there. Now, as soon as they went and talked to the local soil and water conservation district folks, they pulled up the maps and they said, yep, right there's a tile line, and we know exactly where it is, and we can
What'd
remove
they
that
do?
Tile line. Well, they came in and we dug it up and we removed the tile line, and that took care of that issue. We rerouted it. So you can't just remove it, but you rerouted it and moved it, you know, and dealt with drainage. Drainage in Ohio is a big deal, and as you get through development of urban development coupled with the agricultural intensity that we have in Ohio and that urban intensity of development, drainage has become a very big deal in making sure that you know, you can't just shut off the water. We got to make sure we have good drainage plans that work for both of these environments, urban and rural environments, and when they interface like we do here in Ohio, that becomes a big challenge. And I know right now the state actually has a task force they've put together that's looking at our drainage policy in Ohio because it does need to improve because the coordination just isn't there as well as it should be.
Okay.
I'm actually serving on that task force, and it's really a complicated issue. And maybe a lot of people don't realize that 2 or 3 feet below our fields, we often have clay tiles, and 3 to 4 feet below them, we often have plastic pipes. And it's a network, and if you don't know where the network is, and most of these are put out there a long, long time ago, so it would be paper copies on maps that would be there. Then there are ways of finding those, but it's quite an exercise to find out where buried pipes are that run through fields. So you can't dig up the whole field. The cost and the impact on the environment to do that would be astronomical. So it is quite a challenge. So it's very common that when someone does an excavation and they come across a tile or a plastic pipe, they'll just break it there and stop the flow at that point, but they won't necessarily find where it goes through the whole system.
Adam Sharp of the Ohio Farm Bureau, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
We'll continue our conversation. We are broadcasting live from the Chadwick Arboretum and Learning Gardens 2014 plant sale. For more information about the location on the OSU campus, go to the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. And welcome to our special live remote broadcast from the 2014 Chadwick Arboretum and Learning Gardens plant sale. It's on the Ohio State University campus. For more information about location and times, check out the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Experts blame farmland fertilizer runoff for much of the high algae levels in many of Ohio's waterways, but runoff from urban and suburban gardeners is also part of the problem. Some home gardeners are responding. Maybe you've seen the yard care signage that boasts of the word organic. Perhaps you've noticed the increasing green options for weed and pest control at the garden center. Still with us is OSU Food, Agriculture, and Biological Engineering Professor Andy Ward. And joining us now to talk about what you can do at home to limit harmful runoff is Oakland Nursery horticulturist and educator Kate Wilson. Welcome to the show, Kate.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What are the potential dangers associated with traditional pesticides and herbicides at home?
Well, a lot of, for many reasons, people turn to organics because there is a concern about synthetic fertilizers, but especially pesticides and fungicides being harmful to themselves, to kids, to
are
pets. A lot of people believe so. I'm of that belief as well.
Uh-huh.
And it's really about moderation, everything in balance, and using things correctly. Even though something might be labeled organic, it's really important to remember that just because it's organic doesn't necessarily mean it's safe, that you need to use it according to the label and not abuse any of the products. For example, a fungicide that's organic, like a one that's copper-based fungicide, even though it's organic, if it's misused, it can create phototoxicity in your garden, which is harmful to plants and also to your soil, which is a big deal when you're going organic because your soil is very one of the main principles in your garden.
Is healthy soil.
Yeah, healthy, strong soil, because that in turn will feed your plants, and that will make them disease and pest resistant as well.
Andy Ward, we've been talking about agricultural runoff and so
right.
forth, but development and using up the land for development and the kind of things that happen when people put in lawns versus crops or just natural growth, native growth or whatever, is a problem as well.
Oh yes, yeah, and in fact I'll put a different hat on because I also work on a program called NEMO, which relates to urban areas, and the big difference in general is that when we look at an agricultural situation, people are doing that as a business, and they're going to look at efficiencies, they're going to look at they're also good stewards of the land, they understand the soil health. When we look at the average person in the garden, and I'm probably one of those people, it's either a hobby or a chore. So you're either trying to make your garden look as nice as the neighbors or you're doing it because you enjoy it, but you're kind of an amateur. So we tend to buy all kinds of different products, and sometimes we'll use too little, sometimes we'll use too much. We'll also fairly randomly put the amount of water that we want on a garden. So it's a sort of a haphazard activity. And we don't really give a lot of thought to the fact that that's going to end up in our creeks or our streams.
And there's usually a whole bunch of us in one area doing the same thing.
Exactly.
A bunch of amateurs all in the same subdivision, for example.
Exactly. So an interesting story that I think both of you would relate to and your listeners is when I first came to Columbus nearly 30 years ago, I was a new property owner. And I was out there cutting my lawn and the grass clippings were flying everywhere. And the neighbor came up to the fence and said, you know, you're not allowed to do that. You have to bag your grass clippings. And I said, why? And they said, well, that's a requirement. But anyhow, your grass will die if you don't do that. Well, of course, 3 years later, we actually were told that we weren't allowed to bag grass clippings. And of course, the grass is just doing just as fine, maybe better. So, you know, there's an education problem there as well, but it's also a kind of you want to do better than the people next door as well as the people next door.
Right. We're torn by, you know, dueling needs to keep up with the Joneses
yeah.
and to also do right by the environment. Kate, Wilson, what do we mean by organic when we're talking about lawn and garden care? What does that mean to the average gardener?
Well, organic is kind of a broad term. Mm-hmm. There's lots of different organic gardening methods sort of under that umbrella.
Okay.
And you don't have to be hardened to any certain method, but just to understand some basic principles, when I hear organic, I immediately think something more sustainable. So that in the end, one of the benefits of going organic is that you don't have to purchase as much product, that your landscape's more self-sustaining. But to switch from synthetic to organic, it is helpful to have some products there.
How easy is it to do that now? How many products are on the market? Is it easy to walk into a garden store like Oakland Nursery and see where, you know, and have a lot of choices for organic or more natural or more sustainable methods?
It is. There are a lot of different companies that produce synthetic fertilizers, also sort of have their hand in the organic as well. But there's another brand that we carry that's probably the most popular that does focus just on providing organic products. The basis of sort of the sustainability of going organic is really about your mind frame and sort of changing that to taking preventative steps. So a lot of the products are more preventative measures rather than you see a problem and then you go attack it. You're trying to prevent those problems from occurring in the first place.
Have you noticed a change in how many people are asking for how to change their methods, how to do something that's better for the soil, that's better for sustainability?
Absolutely. It's really great to see that, too. One of our most popular lines is an organic lawn care line. They are trying to sort of mimic the synthetic. There's like a four-step lawn care program, and now there's an organic four-step lawn care program. And some of the products, for example, that's a really great one is corn gluten. And it's derived as a byproduct from corn syrup. And it's used to put on your lawn. And it's usually, I've seen both liquid and granular, but you spread it on your lawn. And you can actually use it in your garden beds too, but it inhibits seeds from germinating, ideally weed seeds.
Other than the lawn seeds. We had a caller who wanted to know about regulation of lawn fertilizers.
Let me comment on that, and I also like to comment on organic farming as a commercial enterprise versus people doing it privately. In terms of how people use chemicals, and that includes pesticides, fungicides, insecticides, not just the fertilizers, there's actually a label on those bags or those containers that you get with those chemicals. And the expectation is that the person using it is going to follow the label. But there's no way that anyone can provide oversight and regulate whether someone has followed the label. So probably the biggest problem is when people put fertilizer on their lawns. They way over-applicate. Hmm. So they're going to use two or three times or maybe more than a farmer would use. So the farmer, it's money. And they can't afford to lose a crop because they put too much on and they burn it.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to just briefly say something about organic farming as a commercial enterprise. The word organic actually has a legal connotation to it. So if things start going wrong on a commercial farm, they can't just jump in and use something else and become non-organic because then they lose that label. If you're a private citizen doing it for yourself, you're probably going to have more time to watch the crop carefully and figure out ways of overcoming the problem. But if it all else fails and you have to have a little bit of non-organic putting into your system, it's not a big deal. Because really what you're trying to do is grow something in as sustainable way as you can. Okay? But you're not actually constrained by that legal requirement. Mm-hmm. So I think most people are trying to do things where it's sustainable and isn't affecting the environment. You know, so sometimes you're going to see something happen and you don't know what the answer is, and you're going to go down to Oakland Nurseries or something and you might buy something that isn't organic.
Right.
And that'll solve your problem.
And it's no big whoop, but it's different.
But for the commercial person, they can't do that. So that's also why you pay more, is because there's a lot more micromanagement, and typically the yields are going to be a little bit lower than they would with these high input systems that we have as our commercial farms.
Kate Wilson, to what extent does the choice of what you grow dictate how much herbicide or pesticide is necessary? And do you talk to people about that?
Absolutely. You know, that there's a very good saying, you know, right plant in the right place. And it's important to choose plants that will do well in your specific environment, whether you have shade or dry shade or a wet area. There are plants that can tolerate those sorts of conditions. And if you choose those plants that like that can tolerate that condition, then you're not going to need to use as much fertilizer, pesticides, and that sort of thing. So that is one very important component to going organic, is making sure that you're choosing plants that can tolerate certain conditions in your landscape.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I mentioned earlier the lawn service signs that boast organic. How do these outfits operate differently? Andy, are you familiar with them?
Well, they developed a sustainable system which has, first of all, less inputs and more natural inputs. So manure would be a natural input, but then you've actually got to look at where the manure came from. So if it contained all kinds of antibiotics and things like that, it might not be acceptable.
You have some questions to ask the service too.
There are certified organic manures that you can purchase, and then there's some that are not labeled organic as well. So that is a
good point. Just because they're using manure doesn't mean it's necessarily organic.
So typically, if for example, if you're in Grand Lake St. Mary's, and you are a organic farmer, the cheapest manure for you is going to be maybe the person next to you that has some kind of livestock operation, whereas that organic fertilizer or manure might even be from out of state. So there's going to be a huge price differential. So again, it has a big market impact on it, and there's more risk. I mean, there's no doubt that there's more risk. You know, if you suddenly have some kind of a pest infestation or disease problem or something, you can't just run down and get something to solve it. You've got to figure out something that would be organic to solve it. And that may not be sitting there. So, you know, there's more risk for the farmer. And obviously, as it's a business, most farmers aren't willing to take that risk. So you tend to find that a lot of the commercial organic farmers are going to be smaller operations than some of the huge corn and soybean production systems we find in the state.
Kate, we just have about less than a minute, but I wanted to ask you about, you said plant the right plant in the right place. That goes for grass too.
Absolutely.
Sometimes people are trying to grow grass in the wrong place.
Right. Especially if you're trying to go for an organic lawn, it's really important to plant what's recommended most is a tall fescue. And a tall fescue can tolerate sun, shade, and drought conditions best. And not only the type of grass, but then how you maintain that grass is really important too. And you want to leave it, when you mow it, you want to cut high. You want to leave it 3 inches, which is much longer than our conventional methods that we traditionally think of when we think of mowing the lawn. But what that does is also shades out weeds as well. So that's helpful.
Well, we could do an whole hour just on lawns, but we don't have any time left. Kate Wilson, horticulturist and educator at Oakland Nursery's Educational Program, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Andy Ward, professor of food, agriculture, and biological engineering at OSU, thanks to you as well for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks to everybody for listening to our live broadcast from Chadwick Arboretum and Learning Garden's annual plant sale. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.